me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the
things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference. Be seated. Well, I'm Charles Niles from Anamosa, Iowa. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God, a commitment to independence, a threat of going to penitentiary, and AA, I'm sober today. And I was asked by your committee to be chairman of this sixth anniversary of the Blandine Group. But I think it might be wise at this time, and nobody asked me to say this, but to mention the fact that I believe that when the 1960 directory comes out, I haven't seen a copy of it yet, that the Blandine Group will either be at the top of the list or right close to the top as the group that gave the most money to the General Service headquarters. And I think it's a wonderful thing that this group did that. And they've led the way for a lot of other groups in the state of Iowa. That's in the state of Iowa. Now, in AA, I don't think there's any need for a long, drawn-out introduction, because when we tell our story or we're introduced, we pretty well introduce ourselves. So at this time, it's with a great deal of pleasure that first I'd like to read a letter before introducing this man. A letter that the Blandine Group received. It was on the bulletin board down at the club, but I'd like to read it. April 11, 1960, the Blandine Group, 117 and a half Ferry Street, Davenport, Iowa. To my friends in Blandine, on your sixth anniversary, I want to send you my congratulations on what you have brought about in your good part of our AA world in these years now past. This occasion also brings back happy memories of my visits to Iowa in our pioneering time. To all of my friends, old and new, please carry my warmest greetings. I am so very glad that my own sponsor, Ebby, is to be with you. What he did for me and all those who have followed is something for my deepest thankfulness, as I know it is yours. May the coming year be counted among your finest yet. Ever, devotedly, Bill. And with no further ado, I'm going to introduce Ebby T. of Dallas, Texas at this time. Ebby T.
Texas. Coming up in the plane yesterday, I brought a copy of the Saturday Evening Post with me. And I noticed a little story about that law about a man from West Texas who some years ago built himself an electric automobile. And he drove to New York, and only cost him $1.89 for electricity and $6,924 for an extension cord. That sort of tickled me, you see. Exemplary of Texas. Of course, I am not a Texan by birth. I was born in Albany, New York. Went to school there. Started my drinking there. And I also, my family had a summer home in a town in Vermont, which is only 60 miles from Albany. And it was there that I first ran into Bill Wilson. He was born in a town, lived in a town about 6 miles north of the town where I summered. And I guess the first time I ever met Bill was about 1911, which of course is a couple of years ago, even though I'm only 39 along with Jack Benny. Well, in 1912, Bill and I went to school together up there. I left the school I was going to, the private school in Albany. I went up there for a year, which, by the way, set me back a year when I went back to my original school because they didn't like it, my leaving. I got to know Bill pretty well. We became pretty good friends. And I saw him through the years afterward. I took my first drink, I guess it was, in 1914. And Bill didn't start drinking until some years after that. I don't think he started drinking until after he came home from World War I. And we only got together on one drop. And that was when he came to Albany one time and called me up. It was a Saturday. I happened to be in the office yet, Saturday morning. And he said, I'm in town, go on down and have a drink with me. And I said, that sounded good to me, so I went down and I had to show him all my spots in Albany and we took them in. And so happened I was playing around with a bunch of boys then who had a flying service in Albany. We got together with them that night and somehow out of that drinking party came the idea we'd fly up to Vermont the next day, which we did. And we arrived there, both of us crocked, got out of the plane, and I think it was about the first or second plane that had landed in that little airport, and everybody was out there, and everybody knew Bill and I. But somehow, somebody got us into the hangar out of the way, so most of the townspeople didn't see us. And the guy sneaked the car up to the back end, and we got out. But that's the only time that Bill and I ever drank together. I'm not going to go on any blow-by-blow description of drinking. My drinking soon got out of hand, and it went that way for a good many years. I'd sober up for a while on my own, under my own steam, and get squared away for 4 or 5 months. I never could make 6 months, and then I'd go again. But in 1934, I was living in our house in Vermont, all alone, and was trying to paint the darn thing. And I had a ladder, and I couldn't get halfway up that ladder. I was drinking so hard, and I was shaking. And it was about this time that two fellas came to see me. And they, both of them, I had drunk with on many occasions. I don't think that they're strictly... They would strictly be classed as alcoholics, but they're heavy drinkers, and they didn't have trouble with it, but their main trouble, I think, was lust for power and business and things like that. And of course, that old stock market crash in 1929 knocked them out of the running. And they had become interested in an organization known as the Oxford Group. And they started talking to me about some very simple principles, which I had learned as a child, and asked me if I didn't think that Ebbe Thatcher was trying to run his life, and always had been, and why not try to give God a chance? Well, they left me with some pretty good ideas that I liked. And I got a hold of a boss painter who sent me a man and some equipment, and with the equipment, he and I sobered up for the time being, we painted the house. But as soon as that house painting was over, I went right back to the bottle. My interest is gone again. And as a consequence, in the course of 8 or 10 days, I got in trouble with the law. And I had been in trouble twice before that summer, and three times in Vermont, being 6 months in the state prison. But fortunately, one of the men who had come to see me was the son of the judge with whom I was taken before, and I was released under my own recognizance to another man who had been interested in the Oxford Group, and he took me to New York. I stayed with one of these men, and then I moved into a mission in East 23rd Street, which was run by Calvary Episcopal Church, and was run under Oxford Group principles. I don't want to go into what the Oxford Group was. It was a spiritual movement, and they certainly had a lot of good ideas, no question about it. They folded up, I think, because they were always trying to get the key people into the movement, and Christ himself was looking for the man on the street, the man who was a sinner. And I worked down there in that mission. That is, I lived there with 11 other men. We called ourselves the Brotherhood. And we had about 30 transients off the street every night. And I, in the daytime sometimes, I'd get downtown and go to Wall Street, knew some people down there. And I began to hear stories about Bill, that he wasn't entirely welcome down there anymore. He was drinking and gotten into trouble, and he's pretty well down. So I called him up one night, got his wife, and she asked me over for dinner. And that's the story you read in the big book. It's a little different, but only because I happen to be sober and remember it a little bit different. The principle of the thing is just about the same. And Bill walked home with me, and he walked to the subway with me, and he said, "I don't know what you got, but what it is, I want it." I think what he saw was the fact that I was sober for the first time in a good many years. I called him up from Albany at all times of the hour of the night, and here I was in New York, and under my own steam, and not drinking. So when I went to see Bill, I figured he'd either go for this thing whole hog or he'd have none of it. And the whole thing was that Bill was ready for it. And I just happened to be the guy, that's all, that went to it. Bill was ready for it at the time. And Bill and I worked together after he got his feet really on the ground. We worked together quite a while. And I stayed around New York for about 2 years, and then I went back to Albany, my hometown. I was only back there about 6 months, and I had trouble. And I've had trouble off and on over the years. I guess maybe if I wanted to figure the thing out, I could figure up 16 or 17 years where I counted month by month, be sober months, but I couldn't string them out or anything. But I've had a better record since I came to Texas. And since that's a bit of the story, how I got to Texas, it seems that the man in New York named Charlie Milton was in Paris, France, in the summer of 53, and they have a very small AA group there, and they did at that time. And he was there one night, and he met one of these original men who had come to see me in Vermont, one of the two guys from the Archer group. And the guy said to him, "How's old Evie doing?" And he says, "I don't know old Evie, but I hear he's not doing very well." And I wasn't. Well, he says, "You know, I think he's licked in New York." He said, "Do you think there's any way you could ever get him out of there?" The guy said, "I don't know, but I'll try." And he came back to New York. And he did try. And I'm only citing this as an example of what I call AA in action, not just talking about it. He called up the secretary of the intergroup, and he said, "If Evie comes in, you tell him I want to see him." Well, this man had lived in Texas, and he married a Texas girl, lived in Dallas. And I came in there one afternoon, and this girl got on the phone, and he came right over from his office. And the first thing he said to me, "Where do you drink?" Well, I said, "There's a nice spot over here in Third Avenue, let's go." So we went over there, and he bought me a couple of drinks, and we sat down. He said, "How'd you like to go to Texas?" Well, about that time, Texas was farthest from my thoughts, believe me. I had no idea going to Texas, but he began to tell me that he thought that I was licked in New York, and I knew it. I knew I was. I just couldn't throw that blanket of defeat off my shoulders. And he painted a pretty good picture of getting a new start and a new ground, although they say there's no such thing as a geographical cure. I, for one, will vote for it. Anyway, he gave me $5, and he said, "I'll meet you tomorrow night." He met me tomorrow night in the same process. He bought me a couple of drinks and left me with $5. He said, "Now, you're on your own. If you want to go, you call me up." That was Thursday night, and Saturday morning I walked over to his apartment. He says, "You ready to go to Texas?" I said, "I don't know about Texas, but I'm ready to quit drinking. I quit drinking last night." And he said, "Come on up, we get tuned up." So he called up, one of the men he called up Ole Lancaster and Cersei Whaley right here. And I heard the guy said, "Well, send the Yankee son of a bitch down." I heard it right over the phone. Excuse me for repeating the words he used. That was Ole Lancaster. So Sunday night, they loaded me on the plane. And I know that thing, they hardly rolled the doggone steps up to it, and I was out. I wanted out. I was nervous. Charlie never gave me a drink. And I heard afterwards he had a pint at the airport and never gave it to me. And I had quit drinking cold turkey. And there was Cersei and Ole to meet me. And I stayed at Cersei's clinic for a long time. And Cersei can tell you how sick boy I was. I never thought I was going to pull out of that medley. I couldn't convince myself, or nobody else could convince me, that I was in Texas. I really had hallucinations and everything else. But they were patient, and they played with me, and finally it wore off. And I got back to normalcy again. I tell you, it was one time I was there, I know, what was the name of that boy that was there at the clinic that time with you, from West Texas? Well, I can't, anyway, he had to go out to the airport to mail some letters and get them out in airmail, and I said, "I want to ride out here." This is 2 weeks after I got there. And we got out there, and I got out of the car, because he parked right in front of the old terminal, and there was a placard, a bronze placard on there, said, "Love Field, Dallas, Texas." And I had to get out and put my hand on that thing and read it, and I said, "All right, I believe I'm in Texas." But I didn't believe any of these drunks tell me that, you know. Well, anyway, things picked up for me, and I went along for about 13 months, didn't have a drink, and then I got off the wire again and started drinking. But fortunately, that didn't last so long. I drank off and on for about 10 days, and then I finally was pulled out of it. Unfortunately, I haven't had a drink since. That was in 1st of November, 1954. I met some people in Kansas City, two or three men there, asked me. They said there's a lot of things written about the new man and the help for the new man, but there's very little to help a man who's having trouble. And I said, "Well, I ought to be able to speak on that with authority, because I have had trouble often enough. But I don't know what it is. When we get off, we people who have trouble like that, we get off and we don't seem to be able to stop. And I sometimes wonder if the prime reason, the number one reason, isn't the fact that our pride is hurt. Here we are, we've established a big record in AA, and everybody's looking up to us, and we get drunk. And all that's gone for me." And then, of course, the second reason, and it's a pretty good one, is you say, "Well, now that I've started this one, I might as well make a good one out of it. Get a good one rolling." What makes this drink? I don't know. Except it's wrong thinking, of course. I know it was in my case. I know that in the beginning of this thing, I had a picture every time I thought of taking a drink of exactly what would happen. It was like opening a series of doors and walking through them. Each one a little worse, the picture that was presented. Because I might take a drink in a saloon uptown New York, and by the third day I'd be down in the Bowery. And it was always the same thing. I don't care whether it was New York or Albany or Vermont or where it was. The pattern was the same, always downhill. Thought you could get away with it, and it didn't work. I know now that I can't take a drink. I knew that then, but I didn't have any incentive. And somehow when I came to Texas, I found some incentive, some purpose in life. Although I don't know know exactly what it is, but it's just a purpose to keep sober and try to do a little bit to make up for all the years that I wasted. I'm not much of an orator, I never was. But I like to look on the thing and count some of the blessings I have. There are some things I would like, some things I sometimes need that I don't have. But I have to remember the mistakes I made and the blessings I have now. I know that if the chances are, if Charlie Milton hadn't come to New York and gotten after me and really went to work and got me down here, and if Cersei and those boys down there hadn't been back of me, I never would have survived. I never would have had the chance again to get on my feet and to make these trips and to meet all you good people. And I'm grateful for that, and I think that's about all I can say. Thank you.